Hi there, this is Angela Middleton, and welcome to my podcast, I Want to Be A, where I interview high flyers from all industries to find out their journey, how they came to do what they do, what it's like to do their job, and then their advice for listeners wanting to follow in their footsteps. In this series, we cover everything from traditional careers such as accountancy through to the less traditional careers and future industries such as digital marketing and digital publishing.
As you say, you're a junior doctor just sort of starting out into your official sort of role, having qualified, you know, to be Dr. Shaxfield at that point. So tell us how it's gone over the last sort of 6 years.
So over the last 6 years, first moved to the podcast, I was kind of just at the start of my sort of 2 year foundation, which is still, if you want to be a doctor, how the first couple of years go, you do a 2 year foundation where you work as a doctor, but in medicine, surgery, and about six different sort of types of specialties. And then you decide what you want to do. At the end of that 2 years, I wasn't actually really sure what I wanted to do. I thought I maybe wanted to do general practice, but I wasn't sure if I wanted a career in hospital medicine.
After those 2 years, because I know I asked you, you know, what's it like? What's the hours like? You know, we'd heard how stressful it could be. And, you know, so after the end of that 2 years, did you have any different perspective? Because probably was a bit of an eye opener.
I think there are some weeks where sometimes when you talk about your average weeks of 45, your average weeks of 48, that can mean that some weeks are 40, but other weeks are actually sort of 70-hour weeks. And that can feel quite daunting, where I think some rotors I'd sort of work normal days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then we'd have to work Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night, and you'd get to Monday morning and think, oh, how am I still here?
Oh, God, yeah.
Quite stressful. So I took a year out working in hospital medicine where, as opposed to being where you just get thrown into a training program. So at the start of the kind of after you leave medical school, you just apply for a posting and the NHS will say to you, this is your job. You've got six jobs. You don't really have much choice over the rotors. Go for it. And so for the first time, I was able to pick which department I wanted to work in. You know, got to sort of pick my boss and pick my hours. And that was quite nice. And then about 5 months into it, the pandemic started.
I know. Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about that. Yeah. So what were you doing during the pandemic?
So at the start of the pandemic, I was working in a mixture of elderly care and acute medicine. So it's the bit, if you go to hospital and actually you have a chest infection, so the not surgery bit of it, you know, the non-pediatric bit of it. But I had specialisms at that time because of my first 2 years in intensive care, emergency medicine. And so just as the pandemic was ramping up, my department essentially sort of let me free float between them. So in the initial pandemic months, my job was a mixture of working in A&E, working in the intensive care unit, and also in the medical ward. So that's in the sort of COVID only ward. So although we were working between three departments in that first few months, actually, I saw my kind of fair share of what the pandemic had to offer.
And how did that affect you? I mean, must have been pretty scary, let alone the hours you're working.
You know, I think it was quite scary because at the time, what I found quite profound about sort of COVID and coronavirus was not just sort of, you know, how sort of deadly the virus was, you know, in 2020, but it was actually the types of people it was affecting. So two things stick out in my mind. One was I saw a gentleman who sadly passed and he was 67 and he was only brought in because his wife was in. The paramedic said, are you okay? And this was, and some people think of 67 as old, but medically, actually, this was somebody who was fit as a fiddle, on no meds, didn't smoke, drank a glass of wine once a week. And that just leveled him out. And then I started to admit friends and colleagues of mine, so actually other nurses and doctors were then getting so sick, not just they had to stay home, but actually they then had to be hospitalised. And I think when I saw friends and colleagues of mine where I then had to start treating them, that actually, it kind of hit home. And actually, it did make me a little bit afraid to go to work for quite a
bit. Well, it was an amazing job that you did. And it was really shocking, yeah. And people are still getting it really badly now, aren't they?
They are. So obviously, since then, it's changed massively. We now have, I think by my count, six vaccines that have been available. The virulence of it has gone down massively. So the ability that it will hospitalize someone is much less than it was in 2020, but we are still seeing people greatly affected by it, where it will take them out for quite a while, and people are still being hospitalized, dying from it, but not to the numbers that we saw 4 years ago.
So you obviously you've got through that period then,
Yes.
and then what happened?
So just before the pandemic started, I decided that in the next year, what I wanted to do was be a general practitioner. So, the thing about medicine, which I kind of alluded to in the first podcast, is it's a lot of applications where you then sign up for sort of multi-year deals. So the first deal is medical school, which is a sort of 5 or 6 year program. And then after that, you've got the 2 year foundation program. General practice training is 3 years. So I signed up to a 3 year scheme, which I was lucky enough to get onto, and then started sort of the next phase.
Because you at that point you could have opted to being a surgeon, or
Yes.
you could have gone in
So,
a different route. We were talking about that, weren't we?
exactly. So before you pick a specialty, so in your first years, you can really be anything you want. I remember saying that there was something for everyone. You know, do you like sort of talking or cutting or sort of lab work? And you could be a surgeon, psychiatrist, paediatrician. And so general practice, I thought, was on balance the right job for me.
Because you still had that sort of feeling, you like connecting with people and all of that, and I think you like you, that's what you're saying, that you like connecting with public, etc. But what other motivation was it for going the GP route?
I think really it's that continuity of care. So actually, you get to know people. And in my job now, I will treat 3 generations in one household. And it's quite amazing, actually. In that continuity of care, you'll get, you know, not just a mum who comes in whose mood is low, but then you actually get to know their kids, and you get to know the husband. And you think, well, actually, the next time they say, well, I'm feeling low, actually, you know, and you think, actually, I kind of low because of this. And instead of sort of saying, well, actually, you just need antidepressants, you kind of can. You almost act like a sort of spiritual counselor, and actually, you've got the most
Counselor.
medical tools there, but actually get a deeper understanding of people's health.
And how long have you been doing that now?
So, I did 3 years GP training, which took me 3 years. And then I've been doing that for 7 months. Although, what's important to note is that in the training, obviously, you are working as a doctor in a GP practice, but I've been what you would call just a GP, fully qualified for 7 months now.
And so will you run your own practice? Is that how it works, or are you part of a wider practice? Because it strikes me, if ever I visit a GP, which is really, to be honest with you, I can't remember the last time I went, because there's all these online GPs now as well, isn't there? Like things like Babylon and all of that. But it seems to me like it's quite an enterprise when you go into a GP practice now, with all sorts of services being offered. So, and then it looks like, you have a number of different GPs there. And it struck me as if it could almost be quite entrepreneurial for people if they want to run a GP practice. But I don't know. So tell me how it sort of works and what the potential is.
Really quite is a very interesting question. So what a lot of people don't know about GP surgeries is that pretty much all of them are private businesses. So you get a contract from the NHS to provide services, and that's about 95% of surgeries are run under something called a general medical contract, or GMS contract, where you say, okay, that's fine. The kind of patients within this postcode can register, and if they want to show up with a chest infection or this, you know, we will provide them those services. So when you qualify as a GP, you've got two options. Either you can work as an employee of the surgery, or you could go and be a partner. So that's actually, you're a small business owner, you own a share of the business that is the surgery. That comes with the risks and rewards. And different people want to do different things. And of my colleagues, a couple of people said, yep, I want to be a partner. And a lot of people say, no, I want to be a salaried. And actually, the pros and cons of that would be, as a salary GP, you kind of, you work your hours, you get out, and then actually, as a partner, you kind of do have more responsibilities, but then there's that reward. So some of it is quite enterprising. So this not so the other thing is, what a lot of people don't realize is, when you compare and contrast notes of GP surgeries, people are like, well, my GP does this and they do that, and there's all these services. So some GPs might do joint injections. So I do joint injections, which not every GP has to do, but I will do it. And that makes a small amount of profit for practice, but also it's then a service where your patients actually quite like that, because you then offer something extra. Things like, for example, coils for women's health. That's something a GP surgery doesn't have to do, but some do, and the NHS gives you a little bit of profit for it.
So the NHS is like allocating out contracts for all these different types of services to various different GP practices. And if the GP practice, well, I guess you must bid. I mean, can anyone have any type of contract, or do they have to bid for the contracts, or have certain qualifications, or?
You can bid for the contract. There is a growing industry of some private health clinics where sort of it's easy to do, I think, from a sort of big corporation at scale, but it's really hard for just a new group of GPs to apply for a new contract.
Is it? I wondered, yeah.
It's become a lot more detailed, and actually now it's very rare to see brand new surgeries opening up. What tends to happen, say if you've got a new development of houses and a new GP surgery gets built, is you'll either expand an existing surgery where they'll say, okay, fine, this will be technically part of this company, or a larger company who's able to sort of scale and do things like finance and HR will come in and help.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? I mean, I've not really thought about a GP in this respect, but when I talk to people about the jobs that they're doing, they often talk about wanting to start their own business and being more entrepreneurial and being their own boss and all things like that. And that will apply whether someone is in marketing, whether they are a hairdresser, and I assume if you're a doctor as well, it's the same sort of thought. But what tends to happen when someone sort of does that shift? They move for very often from an operator to an owner. And what you often see, let's take the example of the hairdresser. They've been great at hairdressing. They love the interaction with the people. The product, the service they're delivering is amazing. And then all of a sudden they go and they open their own. And all of a sudden their job changes because now they're not doing hairdressing anymore. They are actually managing other hairdressers. They're hiring, they're running, facilities management type staff. They're being an account, they're liaising with accountants, they're paying bills, they're bidding for contracts, they're et cetera, et cetera. I guess the same thing would happen with a doctor or a dentist or anyone in the medical profession who decides they want to go that route. I mean,
Yeah,
is
and
that
so
right?
that's true. So, and every GP surgery is different. One thing that every GP surgery will have by and large is something called a practice manager,
Yeah.
who will tend to sort of act and manage on your behalf. So at the moment, we've had an issue with the roof, and actually, instead of me doing the roof, I will delegate that and say, okay, fine, go out, get some quotes, and kind of I want to know the details, and I kind of will need to sign off. But actually, at the same time, that gets
Get
managed by
sorted,
someone
yeah.
else. And different GP surgeries, they'll do different things. So I had met a colleague of mine for drinks recently, and he also owns a GP practice, and talking about how they did it, and they said that actually, between the GP partners, actually, there's a couple who don't see that many patients, and what they'll then do is they will just spend that time managing. In my practice, we realize that service provision is a huge part of our job and a huge part of our income. So it's a bit strange where we have 11 co-owners, but what we will do is 80% of our job, well, 80, 90, so the vast bulk of it is still actually involved in patient care.
Yeah, because all the rest of it is sort of supporting activities which are not going to be revenue generating, and they're indirectly improving the level of care, but they're not directly re relating to the care. But yeah, I imagine just like any enterprise, there's all those things. Because it was a bit of a shock to me when I very first started my own business that I thought, yeah, I really love recruitment. I love what liaising with employers. I love working with candidates, and then suddenly find that I'm the one who's called on if the loos get blocked up, or the computers stop working, or it's all those w you never thought that you'd end up being the person to put the bins out,
I had like a funny like a few small shocks kind of in that where with the roof, where I'm
Yeah.
like the roof's never been my problem. I've always worked in hospitals or GP surgeries. That's never been my problem.
No.
And there was one thing where got a call at the weekend from the burglar alarm company. Where we're like, why are you
Yeah.
calling me? And like, oh, now you've got to go to the surgery and check it. And I'm like, oh, well, why is that my job? And it's like, well, you can either hire somebody to go and
Yeah.
open it, or and you want someone to be on call. I'm like, well, what happens if we turn the alarm off? You don't respond, and someone's like, well, someone could burgle your building, and actually that'll invalidate your
Yeah.
insurance. We need the insurance for other things, and then
Yeah.
it's just all the kind of the weird, silly things that become your job. But I do
Yeah.
quite like being a manager, and I've got some just amazing employees, which actually you kind of then try to take them on a journey. And you actually, when you start a new project and you then say, like, this is why we're doing the project, and the HR bit of it, I absolutely love it.
Yeah. So you've got your own practice now, have you?
Yes, so I'm a GP
Amazing.
partner, which in sort of layman's terms is I'm a doctor who owns part of a GP surgery. So
Yeah, fabulous.
it's quite a big super surgery. And so I co-own it with 10 other doctors. So there's 11 of us. So quite a lot to have sort of kind of 11 bosses, sort of 11
Well, it's
co-bosses.
amazing, you know, because yeah, I mean, so you've definitely you're such a good example of what can go on with a profession where you wouldn't really consider that it would be anything other than purely what you'd qualified for, you know, because you're now almost obviously you're still practicing, but you're past the sort of the medical learning bit, and you're actually now picking up all these other sort of management skills, human resource management, hiring, you know, facilities management. So it really opens up a whole new world, doesn't it? And even, you know, the interaction with all of your other colleagues, and I guess, you know, there'll be things that you've all got to discuss and decide the strategy and the direction of the practice and everything. So yeah, it must be an amazing opportunity, actually.
It is, and I think there is quite an interesting bit of a fallacy with people who are really smart, who kind of you can be really smart in one area, and then you can then makes you think that actually, if you're really smart in one area, that you can suddenly do other things. And doctors, interestingly, I see doctors do this on loads of things where actually they're really smart at science, and so suddenly they think, well, actually I'll be really smart at politics, and actually they kind of then think their opinions are worth, you know, they're so important, and actually they fall down these holes where actually. And I'm sometimes really guilty of it, where I realize that just because I'm really good at one thing doesn't mean I'm good at something else. And so one of the things in signing up for this business, where you know you kind of buy into a share of it, is I then kind of had to look at the accounts and was like, yeah, accounts, that's numbers, that's addition, that's fine. You know, I'm really smart, I'm really clever. And you sit down, and you think, I don't know what that is. I don't
Probably
understand
looked at a balance sheet before, no.
depreciation of in a computer. What does that mean? And I actually then, you know, had to get an accountant and say, listen, I don't know. I need you to talk me through this.
It's such a great example of what you're saying, that you know, an operator becomes a business owner, and
Massively.
you know, being a business owner is like a completely different set of skills.
Huge.
But you don't have to take any exams to become a business owner. You just sort of open up a company on company's house, and off you go, sort of thing, which is really one of the reasons why so many businesses do fail. You know, in the UK, it's over 90%, especially once you go past 1 year and then 3 years. But so doing it the way you've done it, where you've actually bought into an established organization, is brilliant, because you know you've got that infrastructure. You're not setting up the infrastructure from scratch. If you want to at a later date, you're going to have that background, aren't you? But doing it the way you've done it seems to be an amazing stepping stone. I mean, how did you come by that opportunity? Is it like a common thing for you know, new GPs to do that and to join a practice the way you've done it?
It's fairly rare. I mean, the partnership model is a big part of UK general practice. So, as I said, sort of the vast majority of GP surgeries at the moment will have GPs who work there who own it. Most people in my position would probably choose to work as a salaried, so work as an employee of that GP surgery for a few years and then grow into it. So, in my first year of training, I worked for this GP surgery. It was really good. I got on kind of quite well with them, and I think they could see that I was hopefully a little bit more switched on 9 to 5 and kind of, you know, still did actually have that kind of business thought, but also providing really good patient care. And so midway through my training, they said that one of the colleagues had retired, they'd like to consider me, and so I sort of went for it. So I went seamlessly in one day from a junior doctor one day to then suddenly a kind of business owner, consultant
Yeah,
GP
amazing.
the next.
Congratulations. That's brilliant. And how do you get sort of rated as a GP? I mean, is there some sort of rating system? Because I know when, you know, we had government contracts for training, we were subject to the Ofsted regime, and you'd be inspected and graded, and you know, you had to sort of submit returns of the volumes of things that you'd done, different types of criteria, and that's how you got rated, and that's how you, number one, you know, preserved your contract, and number two, grew it. So is there same sort of thing with GPs?
Yeah, absolutely. So for GPs, our Ofsted is something called the CQC or the Care Quality Commission. It's quite a wide-ranging body, so they will go and sort of, and like Ofsted, they can sort of show up on site and say, right, we're here to inspect, and that inspectorate will cover hospitals, care homes, GP surgeries. So that actually means we then have to be compliant across kind of a number of different things, from infection prevention control, and then actually making sure staff are keeping up to date with, say, like life support training. And then it's also things like making sure, are we monitoring patients with kind of different conditions and drugs, and actually are you keeping that up to date? So we've got kind of, there's quite a lot of compliance, but actually a lot of it does keep patients safe, where they say, you know, actually please make sure you check their bloods every 12 months, etc.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So, I mean, is there like measurements or ratings that well, this is how long it's taken on average to get people better, stuff like that? Is it results focused or activity focused?
So there's kind of two halves to that. So with the CQC, yes, that is, well, that's a lot of that is sort of compliance with regards to, say, patient access, which is a big thing which comes actually from central government. They'll be saying, well, actually, were people able to book in within 2 weeks? The 2 week target is,
Oh, everything.
that's a big thing, that is almost like the 4 hour wait for A&E times. That's the GP thing of
Right.
actually, can people see their own doctor within 2 weeks? We're actually a really good
Yeah.
surgery. It's quite nice that if somebody
Yeah.
says, I've just got a routine issue, you know, something like, I don't know, fertility, you know, it can wait a couple of weeks, you can see me within 2 weeks. Some surgeries
Yeah.
nationally, 4 weeks, and they're starting to lag behind.
Wow. So the 2 week rule is what everyone adheres to. The other thing I wondered was to the degree, obviously it's a medical practice, but the degree to which, and this is me coming at it now from my areas of interest, which is that I know that exercise and nutrition and mindset management with meditation and correct sleep and all of that, can really have a massive impact on someone's health. I've had clients myself where they've started off with me because they think they're a bit fat, they want to get their tummy flat, and then what happens is they start eating the way that I teach, they start working out in the gym, they start sleeping properly, meditating, managing their stress, and all of a sudden someone who's been on blood pressure medication for years suddenly doesn't have to be on it anymore. And so I'm always very aware that of course, there is the need for the medical profession, but there's also so much that we can do from a self-care perspective. I just wondered the degree to which you can get involved with that as a GP and, the sort of services now, is it that are routinely offered and advice routinely offered in your average GP with regard to that, to basically prevention rather than cure, and to some extent cure as well.
Absolutely huge. And here's the problem. It varies from GP to GP.
Yeah.
I had a patient of mine, he's diabetic, and so one, like helping people, like to keep his diabetes well controlled, but also from a financial target, I will get money if that blood sugar gets below a certain point.
Amazing.
However, what would be a really good bit for a win-win is if I can completely reverse that diabetes, check it every year, make sure it's still reversed, tick, tick, tick. And I remember seeing a guy where we were talking about his blood sugars, and he was on kind of blood sugar medication, high blood pressure medication, this and pain, you know, and pain for his kind of knees because he's overweight. And I said to him, I was like, listen, I know, you know, your weight's not everything, but if we talk about your lifestyle, it's like, look, here's a list of 10 medications. I was like, nine of these you can come off. And he
Yeah.
was like, what? I was like, you can come off of nine of them. We can reverse your diabetes, you can come off this, then your blood pressure will drop. And then suddenly, actually, kind of, and I've seen him since, and he's kind of lost quite a lot of weight, where actually something turned for him, where he was like, well, why am I on these meds? I'm like, it's because actually we haven't focused on
Yeah.
your lifestyle. I think, and this is a bit of a personal hobby horse, I think the NHS has pursued the wrong route with regards to weight loss over the last 20 years. I think the very simple calories in, calories out method has not been working for patients. I think counting calories creates a mental strain and burden. I think we need to look at actually why people make the food choices they do. When you then start talking actually about maybe kind of things like intermittent fasting, and people say, well, God, is skipping a meal unhealthy? And you say, actually, no, it's not. You can actually, I don't know if you kind of what your thoughts are on intermittent fasting, but for some things like blood sugars and weight, actually you do it, and then people come and say, actually my sugars have dropped and actually my weight's down.
My view on it is that it is a way of skipping a meal. It is a way of cutting calories, and what it does as well is it just adjusts someone's mindset that actually I didn't die. You know, I was all right eating less food, and I feel actually weirdly a bit better. So now what I can do is not necessarily there's no magic in intermittent fasting. It just means I'm reducing the windows. So what I can do is start to do that in a more less stringent way, just reduce the portion size, change the quality of the food that I'm having, walk a bit more. I don't have to get on a treadmill and kill myself. I can just do a few more steps, go up the stairs, and this is what we see. Because it's not just about, I had someone who reversed, she was pre-diabetic and reversed it,
Oh, well
but
done.
also blood pressure as well. That's another one, isn't it? People think that they're, they've got to take blood pressure medication forever. And but they don't have to if they inhabit these healthy lifestyles. So interesting. So you have a fine, as a doc, as a GP practice, you'll have incentives actually for people to reverse these conditions.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Amazing.
Some of the things where I don't have incentive, but actually, I think I still like to allow people to have a healthier life without medical intervention is, although I can legally prescribe the meds, I think sometimes all the drugs and investigations are unnecessary if we do the right lifestyle thing. So one of the things which I'm quite big into is sort of circadian rhythm setting. So actually in the mornings, making sure people have exposure to bright lights, which really has a sort of beneficial effect on sleep and tiredness, and also for a slightly complicated
Mindset.
reason, if you don't drink caffeine for the first 60, 90 minutes of the day, you drink caffeine throughout the day, but if you don't drink it for the first 60, 90 minutes, what that does to your energy levels is quite phenomenal because of a chemical called adenosine. And I had someone come to me a couple of months ago and they said, oh, listen, like I'm just tired and run down, and actually there's no reason why people are tired. And they said, what I want is a blood test. And I say, I can give you a blood test. I was like, but if it comes back normal, what happens next? And they said, well, I don't know, but I feel kind of quite stuck. And I said, I'm prepared to give you a blood test, but do you want to try doing something different for the first, give me 2 weeks and see how you feel? And I was like, okay. Talked about sort of natural light, circadian rhythm, sort of that, and also talked about caffeine. And I saw them a month later and they just said, I made those changes and my tiredness stopped. And that was it. And so there was no blood test, no investigation. And they just went, actually, I feel great. I feel better than ever. So lifestyle's huge, and
It really is. But also, Lawrence, the way that we think about things, the psychosomatic thing as well. Once we think that something is going to work, the brain sort of emits different chemicals, like either less stress chemicals or more serotonin or whatever. And that can have an impact as well, as you know.
massively. And sometimes with my low mood patients, where there's a psychology book, I recommend them, and some sort of quick exercise, and I'm like, okay, start thinking about it this way. And I think that's quite one of the nice things about my job, about that continuity of care. I'll say, look, well, maybe let's start with this. If you really want tablets, you can. And actually, people come back and say, well, no, like, actually, I feel better. This is fine.
What book do you recommend?
It's Why Has No One Told Me This Before? It's by Dr. Julie Smith. The
Amazing.
reason why I recommend it is actually, I find loads of psychology books really boring. They're quite in depth, and I read, medical journals for fun and for my job to kind of keep up to date as CPD. I don't know, I find it really boring. What's great about this book is it's probably because Julie Smith is quite popular on TikTok, that she knows how to sell an interesting concept in quite a short amount of time. And that will just be like, why are you having low mood? What do you do with bereavement? Why are you feeling these thoughts? And you then kind of look at your thoughts, look at why it's changing your lifestyle, and then break it down. And people will use that book and be like, oh, actually, that's got me 90% of where I want to be. You were going to throw an antidepressant at me, which prescribing an antidepressant is easy, but actually saying we need to do a little bit of work, and maybe I create a bit more work for myself by saying, oh, you need to sort of maybe come back and see me in a few weeks. But actually, we can do a lot.
I mean, I love to hear this. I really do. Are you unusual in this respect, doing this type of stuff? Because as a trainee doctor, I don't, or correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think that you get taught this stuff. Not even very much nutrition, from my knowledge.
No,
As
you
part of the
don't.
general curriculum,
The
no.
nutrition education is really bad. And I think, a part of it is
Crazy
actually
that.
But I think the problem is that the nutrition industry is so conflicted. So it's
Yeah.
anything from actually are fats good or fats bad, are carbs good or carbs bad? Should we have mini meals or skip meals? You ask different dietitians and they'll say different things. I think
Yeah.
that's part of the problem. There's an excellent book in this, a book on this by Dr. Jason Fung called The Obesity Code, where he talks about why people will struggle with
I
their weight,
like
why
him.
people have diabetes. Yeah, he's really good. And the start of the book says, well, why are there fat doctors? If doctors are so smart and doctors know everything about the human body, why do you get overweight doctors? And part of that is just the real, conflicting evidence. A lot of it, I think, ultra-processed foods is coming higher up the agenda where people are starting to realize that processing foods is just bad for you.
Exactly. And I think as well, that is also, if you said you have fat doctors, I think that's a case of it's not that they don't know what to do, but like anything, knowing and doing are two very different things. Like, not everyone walks around with a six pack, although we all know how to get one. And we've all got one, actually. It's just covered with a little
Yeah, and
duvet.
I have that
So
myself where I tend to stress eat, and I know that's sometimes something I do, and I've been trying to, unpick it over years, where actually I'll go through periods of stress and then I'll be like, hang on a sec, stress is a symptom which feels like hunger, it's not hunger. And I've sort of started to try to kind of say, okay, fine, well, maybe I'm just gonna have half a biscuit. Like if you want to snack, you can give yourself that impulse, but don't. And it's hard, the knowing and the doing, are very different. And then as it makes me sympathize with my patients who say, well, I've got three kids and actually this tough job. And like, and I'm like, okay, fine. Well, you know what? Maybe I'll might never get you your six pack, but maybe can I get your kind of pre-diabetes reverse your blood pressure down?
Completely, And so as I was saying, this is brilliant to hear, but is it common within a GP for that type of advice to be dispensed, or is it down to the individual?
It's down to the individual. You speak to different doctors, they'll do different things. I think especially on circadian rhythm, natural light, I think I'm one of the only GPs that I know about who I actively advise on that with kind of diabetes nutrition. I think if we're slowly, I think, getting into the sort of lower carb, more intermittent fasting, but it just varies on different doctors. And that is sometimes that's luck of the draw. I mean, maybe people come to me about some issues and I'm not as clued up as the next doctor, but maybe I'm better on certain subjects. And that's, yeah, I think that is an issue with healthcare is that you see different doctors and the quality of advice you can get will vary.
And it's not mandatory yet, although maybe it might be in the future for a GP practice to actually advise on things outside of medication. It's not mandatory for you to actually give nutritional advice or
No, and it's
psychological advice.
part of the burden of general practice. There's just so much that comes our way from everything from ADHD, family planning, then you've got
So
heart disease.
much.
There's just so much. And one of the big problems when the government says, well, we'd like you to start doing this is general practitioners will say, well, we're doing all of this. If you
We'd love
add
to, but
this, are you going to pay us more money? Or do you provide an additional member of staff? So is there actually maybe not a doctor, but someone, and there's a lot of different people now who work in general practice surgeries. And that's changed massively in the last 5 years. So I think there might be a role for nutritionists or sort of dieticians in the next few years to come into GP
Yeah,
surgeries.
100%. So, obviously, I met you before, and actually, you are looking very trim and fit
Thank
despite
you.
all of the hours and everything. So, have you changed your actual fitness regime, or
I have. It's not as good as it could be, and I think I'm so constantly sort of striving to be a little bit better. Several things changed for me. I think intermittent fasting's been big one for me. I think when I started to understand sort of macros and understand actually the human body, I'm like, well, what's glycogen? What's insulin? How's that working? I stopped doing night shifts. That was a big thing. Night shifts absolutely killed me. I still work evenings and weekends, but night shifts killed me, and started to actually exercise quite a lot at home. So you might see in the corner of the screen there's kind of a saddle of a spin bike, which
I see,
keeps me on my toes, and also kind of have a built like a little home gym.
Amazing, yeah. So it's all going in the right direction, and it's what we advocate across the board. So it's lovely that to see that someone who's dispensing advice like this, obviously you know you really prioritize all of that as well in terms of your own sort of health, but also advising other people. It's amazing. So I think that from this podcast has been so useful, you know, for people that have been listening at the beginning of how to enter the profession. You've just given such a great overview of what the next steps could be. I think it's really, really exciting for junior doctors as a potential. Anything else to add about the other things that, you know, people could do if they hadn't sort of followed the route you've gone, the more sort of I would call it the entrepreneurial route, but you know, I guess
Yeah.
I'm talking here about, you know, the partnership versus salary. But if people are sort of, oh, you know, that stuff's not for me, but I still want to get on in the profession, what do some of your counterparts, what have they gone on and done?
So there's a lot of other things you can do. So some things that you can do with general practice, you can work in something called occupational health. So where you work for a big company where if members of staff have got problems with mental health or back pain, actually you would then see them and say, well, actually, what's going on with your workplace? Actually, show me your office, show me your sort of tasks and do that. So that's one thing. There's a lot of doctors in the media. I personally, I'm writing a book at the moment, so that's kind of my kind of future endeavor.
What's it on? Or can you not say?
So it's a really funny thing where as a doctor, you kind of have to learn all this kind of, anatomy, physiology, and all these kind of complex concepts. But what I find, Rich, is that friends of mine will ask me medical questions, but there's nothing you actually learn at medical school. So they said, well, if you swallow a piece of gum, how long does it take to go through your intestine? Or how do you actually cure a hangover?
Yeah,
And
very
sort of, or what is an
practical
ice
thing.
cream headache? Or why does that happen? And how do you actually cure it? And so in doing this book, I've written sort of just about two thirds of it at the moment and sort of loads of mini chapters. And what I find really interesting, so on, well, how much water do you drink a day? Or do you need to, how long do you wait after eating before going swimming? Is not only do I find loads of these myths are actually incorrect, you then go back to find the original source of it. That's my passion project that I sort of
Oh, that's
work.
amazing. You're doing that. Yeah, that'll be what I must talk to you about that once it gets published then. Yeah. And then I suppose you've got the route where people sort of work their way up into in NHS itself and become a surgeon, and then maybe they become a consultant surgeon and they go that route, I guess, do they?
Yeah, so there's also sort of hospital medicine for those people who choose it. So I also, from the general practice point of view, I know quite a few GP colleagues of mine where they actually work in hospitals. So most surgeons will end up working in hospitals, but if you became a GP, I know some GPs where they'll work in the accident and emergency, and they're great people. So actually, in A&E, you've got all sorts. So you've got the really, really, acutely sick people, and okay, that's looked after by an A&E specialist. But you've got general practitioners who'll see the people who've come in with a headache, and they'll actually got that really good level of risk because they're not used to having instant bloods, instant scans, will say, no, that person's fine, or actually, oh, we'll hold on to this person. I know one GP
Yeah.
who works in elderly care, and they're actually really great at, when people come for a chest infection, but they'll be like, look at these meds, they need, let's cancel that medication,
Brilliant.
walking stick
Yeah.
needs adjusting, and they'll change it.
Oh,
So
that's lovely.
it's,
Yeah.
as an industry, it's going through a bit of struggle and strife at the moment, but I think as a career looking forward, it's still interesting. It has loads of different avenues that people can pursue.
And I think I think what, you know, what you've demonstrated is there is a lot of potential for people to sort of find their true calling and spend more time in that area. So for you know, it's your book, it's your interest in the psychological side of it, nutrition, etc. So it's not just sort of one dimensional. It seems like there's a lot of potential there. So,
Oh, massively.
well, you're doing an amazing job, and yeah, really, really super impressed. So thank you for giving us a summary of this next edition. Thank you so much, Lawrence. Really, really a pleasure to see you again, and best of luck with you know, with the book and everything else as well.
Amazing. Thank you, Angela.
If you enjoyed this podcast and found it useful, you can get more of the same, no matter where you are in your career. If you're looking for your first job, there's my book, How to Get Your First Job and Build the Career You Want, available on Amazon. Or if you prefer face-to-face, my company Middleton Murray provides courses to prep you for your new career and then place you into a job. Alternatively, if you prefer online, try my online program, Your Body Means Business, which is more holistic and provides a complete blueprint on how to advance your career, whether you're employed or running your own business, by upgrading your physical and mental fitness and following a complete business blueprint guaranteed for success. That program, I think, is my best yet. So in summary, no matter where you are in your career, starting out, starting again, or just wanting more, we can help. Follow me on Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, where I post daily at Angela Middleton. And subscribe to this channel, as well as my Limitless vlog on YouTube, where you'll see weekly vlogs full of hints and tips for enhanced careers performance. And share this with your friends as well, if you think it will help them. Thanks so much for listening.